Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And starting with the headline across the top of the page, RDU Chief links incentives to air service. And this article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Morrisville. And the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. To the far left, there's a picture of a man in coat and tie standing outside of an RDU sign. The caption reads, Michael Landguth aims to enhance the process of getting new service. Raleigh-Durham International Airport may offer or facilitate targeted financial incentives to airlines as part of an intensified pursuit of direct flights to the West Coast, its new chief executive says. Airport Director Michael Landguth says incentives are one of several means to entice airlines to connect directly from RDU to San Francisco, Jose, the European continent, and other desired locations. Landguth has been on the job for 3 weeks, taking the helm from John Brantley, who retired after serving as director since 1982. Landguth aims to enhance the recruitment process, he says. You can't just rely on the strength of your economy anymore. Landguth was CEO of Chattanooga Metropolitan Airport from 2004 until early November. In Chattanooga, Landguth served as vice president from 1999 to 2004, and then as CEO before his move to RDU. Christina Siebold, a spokeswoman for the Chattanooga Airport, says airlines responded energetically to incentives offered there. One big coup was with U.S. Airways, which already connected the airport to its Charlotte hub and added a flight to Reagan National Airport near Washington, D.C. in 2004. Marketing incentives, which relied on contributions from the federal government and local businesses, typically added up to tens of thousands of dollars, depending on the frequency of flights on the route, Siebold says. Mike was very innovative in the opportunities he looked for and took advantage of, Siebold says. Targeted incentives are common among airports and can take many forms, including subsidies from airports and partnerships with local businesses, according to industry insiders. In the interview, Landguth said one possibility would be to fund marketing efforts for a new route. Other common incentives include waiving landing fees on a new route and guaranteeing that the airline will not lose money on the route. Some airports that receive Federal Aviation Administration grants are limited in the direct subsidies they can provide, but it's common for large local employers, particularly those whose employees use the new route, to fund guarantees, marketing expenses, and other incentives, airline industry consultant Robert Mann says. If it's a big winner, nobody ever draws on the guarantee, Mann says. Still, Mann calls targeted incentives a slippery slope, and another analyst says they aren't always effective. They appear to work in some markets, but not in others, says Kurt Krummenacher, senior U.S. airports analyst for Moody's Investor Service. Mid-size airports tend to use them to make airlines already serving them aware of the strength of a particular route. Incentives often last for the first year of operation, Krummenacher says. Some skeptics argue that the end of an incentive is often the end of the route, he adds. In waiving landing fees, an airport forgoes annual revenue in the range of $10,000 for each daily flight, Krummenacher says. But that can vary widely because airports vary so widely in the landing fees they charge. Under Brantley, the airport's fees for takeoffs and landings were among the lowest for mid-size and large airports in North America. That and the Triangle's strong economic growth have made the airport attractive to airlines. Through his tenure, Brantley avoided targeted incentives. No carriers fly nonstop from RDU to the West Coast or continental Europe, though Delta Airlines has in the past offered nonstop service to Los Angeles International. A nonstop flight to San Francisco or San Jose, the northern and southern ends of Silicon Valley, has been a priority for business leaders in the Triangle. And while American Airlines flies nonstop to London, some airport board members have indicated they're hoping for a continental route. In the interview, Landguth discussed several other of his evolving priorities for Raleigh-Durham, including the new director expressed confidence in his lieutenants. I don't see any changes of the leadership we've got here, he says. At a recent airport event, the parking manager, she was out there with her deputy, physically directing traffic. That's leadership. That's getting out front. Landguth says he doesn't envision significant reductions in the airport's cash reserves, currently $138 million, which is enough to cover nearly 2 years in operating expenses at recent rates of use. While the airport could invest the money more profitably, Landguth notes that such investments would be less liquid. The airline industry is extremely volatile, he says. There can be big swings that can occur, so you have to be prepared for that. Landguth says he, the board, and staff haven't set any new priorities for capital projects. Landguth now rents an apartment. His wife and children will remain in Chattanooga, in the Chattanooga area, until they decide on a local school and then begin to look at houses, he says. TBJ web editor Chris Basden contributed to this report. And for our next article, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, we go to the middle of the page where there's an article. It takes up most of the front page. It has a black border around it. Inside that border, the top third is a picture inside of a store showing all the shelves. The caption reads, Gander Mountain Stores Compete Against Bass Pro Shops and Cabela's. Then under that, in bold black lettering, is the headline. Gander, taking a look, retailer of outdoor gear in talks to open store here. And this article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Morrisville. And then next to the article, there's a an area with a blue background. And at the top of that blue background, there's a picture of the outside of one of their stores. And then under that, it's headlined at a glance with some facts about the store. Those facts, Gander Mountain Company, headquarters, St. Paul, Minnesota. Stores, 115. Revenue, $1.06 billion as of 2009. Founded 1960 as mail order retailer. Top products, firearms, fishing rods and reels, kayaks, motorboats, hunting and hiking boots, GPS devices, tents and sleeping bags, backpacks, and other luggage. St. Paul, Minnesota-based Gander Mountain Company, a retailer of hunting and other outdoor gear, is aiming to open a location at Park West Village, which would be its fourth store in North Carolina and first in the Triangle. Representatives of the company haven't signed a lease, but people close to the deal say they expect that to happen within a few weeks. They gave no indication of when the store might open. When and if it does, it would fill a gap in the Triangle's retail terrain. The company's two prime competitors are Pro Bass Shops and Cabela's, and for years reports have surfaced that one of those retailers would open here. Dick's Sporting Goods also is a competitor of Gander Mountain, but Dick's offers a more diversified stock of sports gear. Dick's has 7 stores in the Triangle. Gander Mountain stores offer a range of gear for hunting, mountaineering, camping, and other outdoor sports, including high-priced and sophisticated gear such as Garmin GPS devices. Charlie Anderson, a Minneapolis-based analyst for Doherty & Company who covers Garmin Limited, says Gander Mountain is a leading outlet for Garmin sales. In total, Gander Mountain has 115 stores, all east of the Rocky Mountains. It reported $1.06 billion in annual revenue during the year ending January 31, 2009, its last fiscal year before being taken private by its major shareholders, interim CEO David Pratt and the Erickson family. The Park West Village Shopping Center at the intersection of Cary Parkway and Chapel Hill Road in Morrisville is anchored by a Target discount department store. Other tenants include TJ Maxx, Dress Barn, Rack Room Shoes, Bye Bye Baby, and Hallmark Gifts. A Ross Dress for Less is expected to open in early 2012. The openings began in October, making Park West Village the first new major shopping center in the Triangle in more than a year. One person close to negotiation says Gander Mountain is negotiating for about 50,000 square feet of space, which would make it the center's third largest tenant behind Target and a planned movie theater. Gander Mountain spokesman Jess Myers declined to confirm the retailer's plan, saying company representatives won't talk about a store before signing a lease. A store in Morrisville would fill a geographical map gap for Gander Mountain. It now has stores in Greensboro and Fayetteville, an hour and 90 minutes away, respectively. A third store is in Mooresville, a half hour north of Charlotte. Gander Mountain's landlord in Greensboro says the store draws shoppers from as far away as Durham, a key factor in the retailer's decision to locate next to Interstate 40. They're a great tenant, says Ron Mack, Executive Vice President of Curry Corporation, which owns the Greensboro Shopping Center. And we have one last story on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This one runs vertically along the right side of the page. The headline, Raising Money, Reichard's Ace. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dayline of Chapel Hill. But then underneath the article, there's a picture of Governor Beverly Perdue. The caption reads, Reichard raised money for Beverly Perdue's successful run for governor. Peter A. Reichard, a business executive charged with obstruction of justice in connection with an investigation into the 2008 campaign of Beverly Perdue for governor, is a well-known figure in both political and business circles in the Triangle and in the Triad. Living in Greensboro and working in Chapel Hill for years, Reichard, 54, has successfully worn two hats as both a boutique investment banker with his own firm, Tryon Capital Ventures, and as an ally of some of the biggest political names the state has produced in recent years. Both clients and polls seek him out because of his ability to raise money. Before managing the finances of the Perdue campaign in 2008, Reichard was finance director for Governor Mike Easley in 2000 and then U.S. Senate candidate Erskine Bowles in 2002. All told, he reports raising in excess of $40 million for all three campaigns, some $18.5 million for the successful Perdue election effort. He has the best attributes of a political fundraiser, persistence, and contacts, says Gary Pierce, a Raleigh political consultant and author. Reichard has retained Pierce and his company, Pierce Research Associates, to advise him on media dealings in connection with the changes growing out of the Perdue campaign finance case. Pierce says Reichard's attorneys have advised him not to make any public comments. The charge against Reichard, brought by a Wake County grand jury and pressed by District Attorney Colin Willoughby Jr., stems from allegations that he solicited $32,000 from a Morganton businessman, funneled the cash through Tryon Capital, and finally into the hands of a Perdue campaign staffer, thereby sidestepping the legal limit on campaign contributions. Surrendering to Wake County authorities, Reichard was released on a $50,000 unsecured bond. Pierce says Reichard and his attorneys are attempting to resolve the charges as quickly as possible. Reichard began Tryon Capital with a Chapel Hill partner, Pete Coker, back in 2004. The company's list of deals done is long and varied, starting with a series of transactions that pump both cash and financial advice into such firms as eTrials, Smart Online, Evolve Golf, and Rocky Mountain-based FabX Corporation. More recently, Tryon joined with another Triangle-based investment firm, Carborough Capital, to acquire a hip Chapel Hill grocery store, a Southern Season. Financial terms of that deal were not disclosed, but the partners have made floor and back office changes to put the store on a firmer financial footing. We certainly wish them the best with all this, Carborough Capital Vice President Brian Favre says of the charge facing Reichard. Another relatively recent activity of Reichard has been the setting up of so-called blank check companies, shell-like corporate structures intended to merge with other firms. The combined entity would then have a ready-made float of penny stock to begin to market. U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission documents show that Reichard filed papers with the agency to set up at least 8 blank check companies and that he subsequently merged at least 3. The SEC's Pamela Long, assistant director of the agency's corporate finance division, fired off a series of letters in 2010 and 2011 asking Reichard detailed questions about the blank check operations, explaining that the purpose of her inquiries was, quote, so we may better understand your disclosures, unquote. The documentary record shows that the SEC came away satisfied by the responses. Other parts of Reichard's background are as varied as his business endeavors. A 1979 political science graduate of Guilford College in Greensboro, he sits on the college's board of visitors. He also served a 6-year stint as president of the Greensboro Chamber of Commerce. Reichard also figured in a late 2010 Huffington Post story revealing that he is the son of Ram Dass, formerly known as Richard Alpert, a Harvard psychology professor who was fired, along with Timothy Leary, back in the 1960s for experimenting with LSD. Transformed into a national celebrity, Das migrated to India seeking enlightenment and wasn't reunited with the son he never knew until decades later. Wrote Huffington Post Sarah Davidson at the time, he, Reichert, looks like Ram Dass, tall with the same features and receding hairline, but he speaks with a Carolina drawl, eats pork, enjoys cigars, and describes himself as pretty shallow. Spirituality does not run deep in me. He had to go on a crash course to learn about Ram Dass. For months, he said, I was drinking from a fire hose. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the biz column. The headline that starts it off, The Rat in the Alley to Live Again in Chapel Hill. And under that, there's a picture of a store in Chapel Hill. The caption reads, Chapel Hill once again will be home to Rathskeller. In its heyday, the Rathskeller was the place to be and be seen in Chapel Hill. Located in the basement of stores fronting Franklin Street and accessible only through a pedestrian alley, the Rat closed about 2 years ago after nearly 60 years in business. Now, Diane Fountain, a UNC Chapel Hill graduate and Wilmington developer, says she's putting up nearly $1 million to bring the Rathskeller back to life. She's recruited Bill Donovan, head chef for the Raleigh Convention Center, as general manager. Reports a UNC Chapel Hill website called Reestown. New menus are being worked up that will include some old favorites, such as the lasagna cheese bowl and the gambler, a skirt steak served with sizzle on a flat iron. New items also will be added, both in terms of food and decor, that will, quote, kick it up a few notches, unquote, Fountain says. She is even trying to line up some members of the wait staff who were part of the lore of the Rat. Look for an opening in early 2012. AMR Corporation's recent bankruptcy filing sent shockwaves through the nation's aviation industry. While the company's creditors and stockholders may be worried about the future, officials at Raleigh-Durham International Airport already had taken steps to protect the airport. Spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin writes in an email that the RDU Airport Authority holds a performance bond from American in the amount of $1.6 million. The airport also has a $247,000 bond for American Eagle, AMR's commuter subsidiary. The Airport Authority has in place an accounts receivable policy that requires an airline whose credit rating falls below an investment grade to provide the Airport Authority with a letter of credit or bond in an amount equal to all rents, fees, and charges for a 90-day period, Hamlin writes. American and American Eagle are current on their payments to the authority, she says. Don't forget the furry ones this holiday season. Homeless pets enjoy treats and toys as much as human kids, and the Animal Protection Society of Durham is holding a donation drive during the holiday season at the Durham County Animal Shelter. Among items being sought for dogs are small bite dry food, chews and soft treats, toys and balls. For cats, dry adult and kitten food, small plastic balls and jingle toys. Tis the season. For the 34th consecutive year, the North Carolina Bankers Association and Wake County Human Services have kicked off their holiday Warmth for Wake campaign. Donations are accepted at all bank branches in Wake County. The money goes to provide energy assistance to those in need, with no administrative costs involved. During last year's campaign, more than 200 households received assistance with their energy costs. More than 40 homes received free firewood. Facing the fact that property values are down as much as 10% from the last revaluation, the Chatham County Board of Commissioners has voted to postpone the next review from 2013 to 2015. County officials say a revaluation likely would result in about a 7 cents increase in the property tax. Commissioners voted 3-2 to postpone the revaluation, with the majority citing higher taxes as the reason, reports the Chatham News. Seems the Carolina Hurricanes just can't catch a break. The December 3 game against the Pittsburgh Penguins left a sour taste for many fans as thousands missed most of the first period because of a traffic jam near the RBC Center. The culprit? A high school football championship game that was played at Carter Finley Stadium, adjacent to the arena. The football game got over just when the hockey game was about to start, and Trinity Road, Edwards Mill Road, and the smaller roads to the arena were a mess. People were honking, screaming, and generally frustrated from what Biz saw. Moreover, the Hurricanes canceled the team's morning skate on Saturday, the day full-season ticket holders were to be given access to the players and coaching staff. New coach Kirk Muller did come out to talk to the crowd to explain why he canceled the practice, and a smattering of boos was heard in the back. Biz continues to be optimistic about this team and its prospects, however. In Situ Studio in Raleigh has been honored in an international competition to design a mobile schoolhouse for Burmese refugees in Thailand. Building Trust International, a volunteer professional organization, commissioned the design for refugee children whose schools can be uprooted when Thai landlords cancel leases. In Situ was one of nine architectural firms receiving honorable mentions from the organization. Building Trust International plans to build the winning design, which was by two architects from Berkeley, California, and possibly some of the others, according to In Situ co-founder Matt Griffith. Leadership Triangle has unveiled its 2011 Goodman Awards, named for Capital Broadcasting Company's Jim Goodman, Chair Emeritus of Leadership Triangle. The awards recognize outstanding, regionally-minded Triangle leaders and organizations. This year's award winners are individual, Dennis Gaddy with Community Success Initiative, a nonprofit that helps men and women transition from prison to the workforce. Public official, Mike Woodard, member of the Durham City Council, who worked to advance long-range transportation plans in the Triangle. Goodman Fellow, Robin Schreier Fearman, with Teach for America, Eastern North Carolina, who, through the Triangle Community Foundation, established the community grant-making program that has granted nearly $2 million to organizations across the Triangle working in civic engagement and youth leadership. Organization, Triangle Residential Options for Substance Abusers Incorporated, TROSA, which helps substance abusers to recover. Partnership, Falls Lake Stakeholder Project, which works to improve the water supplies from Falls Lake. Garner's Scotty McCreery is going to be a busy young man after the start of the new year when he joins headliner Brad Paisley for a 21-stop tour beginning on January 12 in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The tour wraps up on March 4 at SeaWorld in Orlando. In between, the American Idol champ and booster of his Garner High School Trojans will see a lot of arenas and even make a stop on January 28 for a Saturday show at the Mandalay Bay Resort in Las Vegas. Once the tour ends, McCreary's show schedule is clear, save for a booking on October 15 in Dorton Arena as part of the 2012 NC State Fair. A Charlotte real estate company, led by former state senator Robert Pittenger, has purchased a 219-acre parcel on Olive Branch Road in Durham, its first buy in the region, that has been slated for residential development. Paragon Commercial Bank of Raleigh foreclosed on the land in November and sold the land to Pittenger's company for $3.24 million in December, according to Durham County records. Robert Pittenger Company has for years bought and held properties in Charlotte, Nashville, Tennessee, Austin, Texas, and Charleston, South Carolina, for future development. Contributing to Biz were staffers Chris Bagley, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, and Chris Baisden. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to has the headline, Rolling a $60 Million Bet, Centerex Leaders Bullish About Drugs Potential. And above the article, there's a picture of two men sitting in a conference room. The caption reads, Mark Barrick and Barry Brand head up Centerex and Cary. The article is written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Cary. Anyone who knows Mark Barrick, the chief financial officer and COO of Seer Technologies before the company was sold, knows he's not shy about laying out the possibilities of his ventures. True to form, Barrick once again is high on the prospects of Centerex, a biopharma, a Cary biotech company that he and chief executive Barry Brand hope to sell for $1 billion in 2012. Cinerix is in the middle of a phase 2B trial for Trirema, a drug to treat psychiatric and neurological disorders such as depression. Naturally, reaching a large deal would depend on many factors, including the outcome of the trial and demand from potential suitors in Big Pharma. This has a chance to be a game changer, Cinerix president Barrick says, believing Trirema could reach $5 billion in annual sales, an amount that would eclipse the annualized $4 billion raked in by Eli Lilly for antidepressant Cymbalta. Investors are counting on him to be right. Since 2005, life science venture capital firms, including Durham's Pappas Ventures and Aisling Capital of New York, pumped nearly $60 million into Cinerix, including $4.85 million in November. The company's board is comprised of four venture capital members, only one of whom is a medical doctor. As for management, Brand brings 20 years of pharmaceutical marketing experience, much with what is now GlaxoSmithKline. And Dr. Dan Birch, the chief medical officer, brings 15 years of experience in the clinical development of new medicines at Abbott Laboratories, SmithKline Beecham, and GlaxoSmithKline. Management and board are rolling the dice that they can nudge their way into a crowded market. There is no shortage of drugs to treat depression, a market that Harry M. Tracy, a psychologist and publisher of NeuroPerspective, says peaked at $20 billion per year. Still, no one drug stands out. RTI International, based in the Triangle, has identified 13 commonly prescribed antidepressants, but found no significant differences in the effectiveness of them. Dr. Bradley Gaines, director of the UNC Healthcare Psychiatric Outpatient Clinic, says patients respond to drugs differently, and many doctors use trial and error to find which medication works best for a patient. Only about 30% to 40% of patients recover from a depressive event after the first round of medication, and only another 30% to 40% of the remaining patients recover after a second round with a different drug, says Gaines. That leaves about half of all patients who do not respond, and the likelihood of recovery drops off significantly for those patients. That's where Cinerix hopes to find a niche. Historically, psychiatrists have known that lower levels of the neurotransmitters dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin increase a disposition to depression. Therefore, drug companies have targeted those neurotransmitters in an effort to strengthen them. Brand decided to take a different approach. He asked the question, what causes the level of those neurotransmitters to drop? He found that monoamine oxidase enzymes, commonly called MAO enzymes, metabolize dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin. Those who suffer from depression often have improper levels of the enzymes, affecting how the neurotransmitters work in the body. Targeting MAO enzymes is not new. In fact, that approach was discovered as early as the 1950s when doctors were looking for cures for tuberculosis, says Gaines. They found that inhibiting these enzymes had an effect on mood, but the therapy came with severe side effects, including a high risk of stroke in patients who consumed certain items, including cheeses, meats, wines, or draft beer. Cinerix developed Trirema to reduce MAO enzyme levels, but also to protect against side effects. It has proved to have no cheese reaction, even when given in high doses, according to test results. Gaines, who is not aware of Trirema or Cinerix, says an MAO inhibitor could be used, especially for atypical cases, but cautioned that it is unlikely there would be one drug to cure all depression. Brand acknowledges the point, saying, there is no panacea. In fact, because of inexpensive generics, Brand predicts that doctors would still prescribe existing antidepressants first if Trirema gains approval. When those don't work, however, he believes Trirema would be the next option, a market that he estimates could represent as many as 125 million prescriptions per year. And just to the right of that article, there's another article that runs vertically along page 3. In the Triangle Business Journal, the headline, Parish Capital Sold to New York's Stepstone Firm. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a dateline of Chapel Hill. New York-based Stepstone Capital has signed an agreement to acquire Chapel Hill's Parish Capital Advisors, one of the few minority-owned investment firms in the South. Terms of the deal have not been disclosed, but Parrish, with about $2 billion under management, would see its investment portfolio folded into StepStone, which has $7.5 billion under direct management. StepStone also oversees some $40 billion in private equity investments in the U.S. and abroad. Asked to comment, Charles Merritt, one of Parrish's initial founders back in 2003, declined to discuss the deal, referring questions to a Connecticut public relations firm. Caroline Lutz of Owen Blicksilver also declined to comment beyond the bare basics of the transaction, adding that it is expected to close by January. Merritt's partners in starting Parrish a decade ago included James Mason and Wendell McCain. They were joined 3 years later by David Jeffrey. McCain left his management position with Parrish a couple of years ago. According to an internal memo on the StepStone deal, Jeffrey has agreed to join StepStone as a partner in the firm's London office. Meanwhile, Mason and Merritt will help oversee the transition. After that, the document says both men and StepStone will determine whether there is a long-term employment role for them with the firm. As for other Parrish staffers, numbering at times around 15, the document only says that StepStone expects that certain other Parrish professionals will join StepStone. Parrish is a so-called fund-to-fund investor, taking cash from pension funds and other large institutions and investing it with other money managers in private equity and venture capital areas. Along the way, the company has attracted hundreds of millions of dollars in capital from the North Carolina State Pension System, Duke University, the California Pension System, New York State Teachers, and New York State Retirement Fund, among others. The North Carolina Treasurer's Department, which oversees the state's pension fund for retirees and school teachers, has yet to release a summary of its investment returns by individual money manager for fiscal 2010 or 2011. The California Retirement System, known as CalPERS, in a published report on its investments for 2009 to 2010, says it sank money in Parrish's first two investment funds, a $38.64 million investment in Parrish. One had a market value of $34.19 million as of June 30, 2010, which was 12% below the initial outlay. Meanwhile, a $40 million investment in Parrish 2 had a market value of $37.68 million, 6% below the initial outlay. Charles Leedy, a former investor on the staff of the UNC Chapel Hill Endowment and now owner of his own investment firm, Chapel Hill Investment Advisors, says the large institutional accounts formerly managed by Parrish will simply roll over into StepStone. "This looks like a very good deal for the partners of Parrish," says Leedy, "and the Parrish investors in becoming part of StepStone should be fine, too." And our next article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Triangle Credit Union's Growing Accounts at 6.3% Pace. And on the left side of this article, there's a picture of the from the sidewalk view, the outside of a building, a Coastal Federal Credit Union. The caption reads, Coastal Federal Credit Union saw very little increase in customers during the third quarter. National credit union officials claimed a major shift in customers from banks to credit unions during the National Transfer Day in November. National credit union officials are backtracking on membership growth claims they made in connection with early November's highly publicized National Transfer Day. But even if that social media-propelled anti-bank populism-fueled event turns out to have been less successful than originally claimed nationally, the Triangle's largest credit unions have already chalked up solid 2011 gains, new data show. In fact, the region's four largest credit unions added nearly 173,000 accounts in the 12 months ending September 30. That was good for an average annual growth rate of 6.3%. The four credit unions are State Employees, Coastal Federal, Local Government, all based in Raleigh, and Self-Help, based in Durham. The Triangle numbers were included in just-released third-quarter call reports the organizations filed with the National Credit Union Administration, the industry regulator. Those numbers have not been questioned, but that's not the case with membership gain estimates originally put out by the Credit Union National Association, or CUNA, an industry trade group, based on a survey CUNA now admits was misinterpreted by those who answered it. The group said credit unions nationally would pick up 650,000 new members in the October run-up to Transfer Day. In a news release the week of December 5, CUNA revised the number to 214,000, prompting American Banker, a trade magazine published for the banking industry, to headline its story on the matter, "Credit Unions Eat Crow on Customer Numbers." CUNA, in its defense, points out that the 650,000 figure can be reached if the new member number is added to the number of new accounts opened at credit unions that month. What's really happening with credit union numbers in the fourth quarter won't be known until the actual data is published in early to mid-February. But we are still sticking with the idea that there has been a big movement toward the credit unions, says CUNA spokesman Pat Keefe. Even the 200,000 number we put out for October was huge. Meanwhile, in the third quarter, the Triangle's largest credit unions, including State Employees, or CQ, the nation's second largest, have been recording advances in both accounts and membership. Of the 173,000 new accounts, CQ accounted for 80% of them, some 139,470. Moreover, data show that the State Employees Credit Union was adding new accounts at a 30% faster clip, 1.3% versus 0.99%, in the third quarter of 2011 than in the same period a year ago. As for new members, CQ added 75,092 in the 12 months ending September 30, up 4.6%. President James Blaine says the results are about 20% above the historical normal and are due in part to the fact that CQ has grown steadily and now, in fact, has a presence in all of North Carolina's 100 counties. As for Transfer Day, Blaine discounts its importance. This is not a one-day event, he says. It's either going to continue or it was just a flash in the pan. As for the other three organizations, Coastal Federal saw a 0.2% jump in new accounts in the 12 months ending September 30. Local Government Federal Credit Union charted a 5.7% increase, while Durham Self-Help saw new accounts advance by 15%. As for statewide results, Jeff Harden, spokesman for the North Carolina Credit Union League, says he hasn't yet crunched the third quarter numbers and can't discuss statewide patterns. In our next article, written by Jason DeBrun, has a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, NCSU Getting Ahead on Regeneration Work. And along with this article, there's a picture of a man and woman standing in a lab. The caption reads, "Postdoc Molly Purser Chats with Sang-Jin Lee of Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center." Richard Wisk says regenerative medicine is on the cusp of a revolution, and he wants North Carolina State University to be a player in advancing that field. In a move toward that goal, NC State's Edward P. Fitz Department of Industrial and Systems Engineering has formed a partnership with the Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center's Institute for Regenerative Medicine to apply industrial engineering to regenerative medicine. Wisk, a professor in the Fitz department, likens regenerative medicine to the computer revolution, predicting that one day medical scientists will be able to grow organs as easily as computer scientists make chips. "In terms of regenerative medicine, we are where the computer revolution was 40 years ago," he says. "Currently, regenerative medicine is very labor-intensive and not cost-effective, meaning it is still impossible to apply it in new patients in any meaningful way. That's where Wisk says NC State can help. A better manufacturing process applies to growing organs as much as it does to building cars, even if some of the technical aspects are different," says Paul H. Cohen, a professor in the Fitz department. "We certainly don't know how to grow organs, but we do understand manufacturing processes," Cohen says. If the engineering minds from NC State can team with the medical minds from Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center in Winston-Salem, the groups hope to more efficiently practice regenerative medicine, the science of creating living, functional tissue and organs to repair or replace damaged tissue or organs in patients. "The Institute's expertise is in the science behind engineering replacement tissues and organs," says Dr. Anthony Atala, director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine. Our colleagues at NC State are experts in manufacturing and automation. In this partnership, they'll help us optimize the manufacturing process of replacement tissues. If the process of regenerating organs can become streamlined, it could open doors in the same way the moving assembly line helped revolutionize manufacturing under Henry Ford. Postdoctoral student Molly Purser and doctoral students Peter Prim and Sean Carr will take on three specific projects, one to engineer a human ear, one to stretch skin to cover burns, and one to help muscle cells regenerate. If the students find applications for other areas, those would be discussed as well, Wisk says. Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center is financing much of the work, and a $155,000 initial grant from the National Science Foundation also is going toward the project. Regenerative medicine is here to stay, says Abner Makashlager, Medical Translation Officer at the Wake Forest Institute. Another apartment building planned for Glenwood South. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. Blue Ridge Realty is joining the multifamily march into downtown Raleigh's Glenwood South District with plans to build a 209-unit apartment complex called the Gramercy at the corner of Glenwood Avenue and West North Street. It is the fourth multi-story rental property proposed within a three-block radius in downtown Raleigh in the past 9 months. Joe Meir, president of Blue Ridge Realty in Raleigh, cautions that his group has multiple hurdles to overcome before it can decide whether construction of the Gramercy is viable. All I can tell is this is what we are contemplating, he says. Since March, four separate development companies have submitted plans to build four apartment complexes in the Glenwood South District. Combined, they would add 745 rental units to downtown Raleigh's inventory of apartments. That would more than double the number of apartment units in all of downtown Raleigh built since 2007. The market's newest existing apartment communities, 712 Tucker and Hugh, added 387 units in 2009 and are mostly full, says Ann Cabell Baum Anderson, broker in charge of the Glenwood Agency, which specializes in the sale of and rental of downtown Raleigh residential properties. I think downtown Raleigh is grossly underserved for rental and has been for a long time, Anderson says. But timing is everything. As long as all the projects are not all developed in the same quarter, we'll be in great shape. The site plan for the Gramercy, which would be located in a half block bound by North Boylan Avenue, West North Street, and Glenwood Avenue, shows a seven-story building with a structured parking deck, 209 residential units, and at least one retail space that would front Glenwood Avenue. Blue Ridge Realty already owns and manages an office building at 401 Glenwood Avenue that occupies half of the proposed apartment site. Blue Ridge was a partner with Trammell Crow Residential in the construction of the 222 Glenwood Residential Condo and retail building that opened in 2008. Point Development Company of Bay Harbor Islands, Florida, owns a church that sits on property occupying the other half of the Gramercy site point, along with a group of Raleigh developers, had in 2007 proposed to build an 84,000-square-foot office and residential building on the site, but that project never broke ground. The J. Davis Architects firm in Raleigh is working on either landscape planning or building design plans for three of the four proposed Glenwood South apartment projects, including the Gramercy. J. Davis founder Jeff Davis says multifamily projects in the Triangle, as well as in Texas, Tennessee, South Carolina, and the Washington, D.C. area, make up about 60% of the firm's current work. We've hired a considerable number of people since last spring, Davis says, estimating the firm has added 15 employees in 2011. Upping its staff to 40 people in Raleigh and to 7 people at a Philadelphia office. The firm is still smaller than it was at its peak in 2008, he says, but demand for multifamily development in particular is driving growth in commercial real estate. There's just a lot of energy being put in the design of all these projects, Davis says. We're really being challenged to do our best work. Design sells more than it ever has. Construction of the $21 million St. Mary's Square apartment community will likely be the first to break ground. Northwood Raven of Charlotte has already secured approval from the city and financing, sources say. Southern Land Company of Franklin, Tennessee, with the financial backing of J.P. Morgan Investment Management, has also secured city approval for its apartment project at 425 North Boylan Avenue, which is slated to have 250 units. Harrington Street Partners LLC of Raleigh, which is led by Cary developer Greg Sandruder, is seeking permission from the city to build up to 153 apartment units for a project at 413 North Harrington Street that is adjacent to the West Condominium development that Sandruder also developed. School Dude spinoff Facility Dude picks up growth pace. First out of the box to help schools manage facilities, executives diversified client targets. And that's the headline on the next article, written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Cary. The Facility Dude software company is outgrowing its own facility. The Cary-based company, which was started in 2007 as a spinoff from sister company SchoolDude.com, has expanded its offices by nearly 11,700 square feet at the 1100 Regency Parkway building in Cary. Lee Provost, a co-founder of both companies, says the expansion was needed to keep pace with the more than 20 employees that the combined companies have been adding each year the past 2 years, but most of the new space will be dedicated to Facility Dude operations. That's where a lot of our growth is occurring, he says. School Dude employs about 115 people, while Facility Dude employs about 40 people. But Provost says Facility Dude has about 10 open positions that will be filled. SchoolDude.com was founded in 1999 as a web-based software service to help school districts around the country keep track of their facility maintenance needs. Software services, tracking school business, and information technology operations were added later. School Dude counts among its clients many of the nation's largest school systems, including the Miami-Dade County Public Schools, Fairfax County Public Schools in Virginia, and the Irvine Unified School District in California. The Cary executive soon found out that schools weren't the only organizations that could benefit from School Dude services. Hospitals, government agencies, YMCAs, and private property management groups were looking for alternative solutions to large software systems that required much larger investments. Thus was born Facility Dude. Facility Dude in recent months established partnerships with facility maintenance and repair vendors such as Johnson Controls and Tremco Incorporated that have been steering more business contacts their way, Prevost says. The cloud computing message is very strong right now, he says. Schools and hospitals can't buy the big software systems. We walk in, and if you've got a web browser and an internet connection, you're good to go. When Marty Mitchell was hired as the town of Apex's director of facility and fleet services in 2004, for example, he knew the town badly needed a better system of keeping up with maintenance issues at all of its properties. Prior to taking the job in Apex, Mitchell worked with Wake County Public Schools, which had already implemented many of School Dude's software programs into their maintenance operations across the country. I told them what I was looking for, and their fees were so ridiculously low, he says, estimating that the town spends about $4,000 a year to use Facility Dude's web-based programs. By comparison, he says, purchased asset management software can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to install and use. I come from the private sector, and I think it's important to keep up with cost and track costs, Mitchell says. My two maintenance guys have BlackBerries, and they get the work orders immediately. It makes it a lot more efficient. Prevost estimates that the companies combined have a client base of about 5,700 organizations, and he estimates that revenue in 2011 will be in the mid-$20 million range, will be up from $21.3 million in 2010. In Cary, the companies now occupy about 45,000 square feet of office space, he says. For the latest expansion, Lee Clyburn of Grubb & Ellis, Thomas Linderman, Graham, confirmed that he represented the company, and Jessica Brock of Spectrum Properties represented the landlord in the lease negotiations. City power agencies differ on cost impact of utility merger. And that's the headline on the next article written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Raleigh. Municipal governments and large power users in 40 eastern North Carolina cities are awaiting regulators' decisions on the merger of the state's two largest utilities, which they say has the potential to help or hurt them financially. The towns of Apex, Clayton, Wake Forest, and 29 other municipalities buy about one quarter of their electricity from Progress Energy through the North Carolina Eastern Municipal Power Agency. The agency's governing board voted unanimously in late October to approve a new agreement covering such power purchases from 2018 through 2031. Two of the cities, Rocky Mount and New Bern, had asked the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the North Carolina General Assembly to intervene, saying Progress's acquisition by Duke Energy could stifle competition in power markets. Officials at Electricities, the city's trade organization that represents the 32 cities and 19 in the western half of the state, have said they share those concerns. But Electricity CEO Graham Edwards also acknowledges Duke's and Progress's argument that a merger would allow coal to be purchased in larger quantities, thus reducing operating costs at plants that the Eastern Agency co-owns with Progress. The agency owns a 15% share of two coal-fired plants north of Durham, the Sharon Harris nuclear plant near Holly Springs, and two nuclear units near Wilmington. Progress spokesman Mike Hughes says the cities will share in the savings on electricity they buy and also are likely to share in direct savings on fuel purchases. Meanwhile, the cities are paying down a total of $2.25 billion in revenue bonds associated with their investments in the five plants. The shares of Apex, Clayton, and Wake Forest amounted to about $16 million each as of January 2. The Eastern Agency is scheduled to make a payment of about $130 million in principal and $110 million in interest on the 32 cities' behalf in early January. Electricity spokeswoman Rebecca Agner says the Eastern Agency expects to finish paying off its debt in 2025. Association spokesman Ken Raber says that the Eastern Agency and its Western counterpart, North Carolina Municipal Power Agency 1, have no immediate plans for additional borrowing. And now we turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Franco out, Drutz in at Dara. Dara Biosciences Incorporated Chairman and CEO Richard Franco will retire on December 16. Dr. David Drutz, a board member, will step in as interim CEO, the company said in a prepared statement. The company disclosed November 23 that the NASDAQ exchange had threatened it with delisting because the value of its shareholder equity had fallen below NASDAQ's $2.5 million threshold. Dara has reported no revenue this year. Its loss of nearly $1 million in the third quarter left it with equity of $2.34 million, despite issuance of additional shares in the quarter. President Obama appoints Freelon to Arts Commission. Add yet another accolade for Durham architect Phil Freelon, founder of the Freelon Group. President Barack Obama has appointed Freelon to the U.S. Commission of Fine Arts. The commission, established in 1910 by Congress, is composed of seven experts in the field of fine arts. Commission members serve four-year terms without compensation. I am grateful that these impressive individuals have chosen to dedicate their talents to serving the American people at this important time for our country, Obama said in announcing the appointments. I look forward to working with them in the months and years ahead. Optimism growing, but CPAs still downbeat on economy. Optimism about the economy's prospects for 2012 is growing among the nation's senior-level CPAs. But the overall mood remains downbeat, according to a new survey from the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. The organization says the percentage of respondents expressing optimism about the U.S. economy rose from 9% in the third quarter to 19% in the fourth quarter. However, 40% of survey takers still describe themselves as, quote, pessimistic or very pessimistic, unquote, about conditions in the U.S. Biogen IDEC partners with Samsung on JV. The Samsung Group is expanding its involvement in biopharmaceutical development through a partnership with Biogen IDEC following an initial investment with Quintiles earlier this year. Samsung and Quintiles teamed to create a Samsung Biologics joint venture in March, with Quintiles contributing $30 million of the $300 million in capital needed for the project. On Tuesday, the Samsung Group said that the joint venture and Biogen will create a further joint venture for developing biosimilars, biopharmaceutical medicines that are similar to existing drugs in composition and effect. A biosimilar drug differs from a generic in that its developer relies less extensively on information from the original drug's development. SAS strikes $6 million deal with IRS. SAS Institute said Wednesday that it has signed a $6.25 million contract to provide its analytics software to the Internal Revenue Service. SAS said in a news release that the IRS will use SAS analytics to help detect, prevent, and resolve criminal and civil noncompliance with tax law. It will support the agency's new electronic return review program system. The RRP is designed to help reduce the $345 billion tax gap, which is the difference between what taxpayers owe and what they pay voluntarily and on time. And we have enough time left just to read the beginning of this next article. The headline, Skinner Cain's Most Valuable in Terms of Points Per Pay. And this is an article written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. When it comes to offensive production, the Carolina Hurricanes are getting the most bang for their buck out of their baby-faced second-year forward, Jeff Skinner. Through 30 games, about one-third of the season, Skinner scored 24 points, tallied by adding the player's goals and assists based on his pay of $900,000. That comes out to $38,000 per point, the lowest dollar per point total on the team. By comparison, Eric Staal, the team's captain and highest played player, has scored only 18 points, meaning he has cost the team $431,000 per point. And we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.